Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 27th of May, 2008. Got an interesting show coming up. We have Angela Conway. She's a spokeswoman for the Australian Family Association. She'll be talking about moves by the New South Wales government, and they're introducing a controversial new bill to remove the word father from birth certificates so as to recognise lesbian couples who have children through IVF. 50 laws across New South Wales covering the Local Government Act, Industrial Relations Act and the Constitution will be amended to include new parental presumption protection for female same-sex couples, heterosexual de facto couples, but not male same-sex couples. You'd have to ask why, and you'd also have to ask why is it necessary to remove the word father from the legislation. This will be passed probably next week. There's a meeting in Parliament House. We'll be getting all the details of that later in the show. We also got Tony McLean. She is a domestic violence expert who runs a program called Think Twice. There's a website and a lot of information up on the Think Twice website. She'll be on, really interesting, particularly at a time when the government has introduced a national council to prevent violence against women and children. Men, of course, are much more likely to be victims of violence than women or children, but they seem to be missing in the equation. It'll be interesting to look at that. We'll also have Richard Farr. He's a leader, international leader in the fatherhood movement from America, and always an entertaining guest. First up, we'll have a look at a bit of the news.
Yes, good morning. From the Daily Telegraph, the headline reads, "The Baby Bond, Dads Matter Too." It's by Claire Masters. It goes on to say, "The stereotype of the father being a bystander in his baby's life could be changed forever if paid paternity leave were introduced. Researchers told the Productivity Commission inquiry into paid parental leave that workplace practices needed to change so fathers felt good about taking off time for their children. We hear stories of dads with babies in intensive care whose bosses won't let them take more than 3 days off at any one time. Many employers still scoffed at men needing to take time off," he said. The story goes on to talk about a father that actually took 6 weeks out of his long service leave for the birth of his first child. I guess that's all good and well if you have long service leave, but if you don't, like many of us, we're left with nothing.
I forgot to say we have in the studio with us Ian Purdy, the author of the Daddy Split Guide.
Thank you, John. Yes, available on lulu.com.
Good on you. And Greg Anderson, our webmaster and researcher.
Morning, everyone.
And Philip York from Dads in Distress out west.
Good morning.
So, what do you think of all this parental leave stuff, Greg?
Well, I think that change is in the air. I mean, I would really like to see that we just have parental leave. The concept of maternity, paternity, partner leave, it's all very complicated. Surely mums and dads should have the equal right to take off time to look after their kids, and that way each family can work out what works best for them. It's crazy that we should have like up to a year of maternity leave and then, you know, some small provision, maybe a week, maybe a month for fathers, and then a different category for people, adoptive parents, and this and that and the other. Parents are parents. Why not just make leave applicable to everyone? That's my view.
And as any parent will tell you, the time flies. They only really need you so much in those first few years, and it's all over. And they're off to school and
into their lives. Then they don't want you.
They hear the Antichrist.
Yeah. And they don't want to be seen with you. Don't come with me, Dad. I don't want my friends to see me with you, Dad. You're uncool.
Go from God to Dag overnight.
That's
a shocking thing.
But look, it's good to see that the Productivity Commission is looking seriously at the issue of giving leave for fathers to take time off to look after their kids. And all the evidence shows that fathers find it a lot harder than mothers to take time off from work because of workplace cultures that say that, well, parenting's still what mums do, you know, and dad's supposed to be the breadwinner. And a lot of bosses still think that way, and a lot of workplace cultures think that way. And about time that changes, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a really... there's a lot of talk about the work-family-life balance, and it's time the blokes got in there and got a bit of the action as well. This is a terrible story, this one.
This one's horrible. This appeared in The Australian last Friday, the 23rd of May. under the heading Mother Guilty of Murdering Sons in Fit of Vengeance, Melinda Rout writes, David Fitchett sat in court every day for his boys. He sat through days of harrowing evidence that recounted how his vengeful wife drugged, strangled, and suffocated his two sons. He got up on the witness stand and testified how he found the cold bodies of his sons after coming home from work, and he wept as he listened to the desperate naught, naught, naught call, revealing his fruitless attempts to resuscitate his two children. Yesterday he had tears of relief as a Victorian Supreme Court jury forewoman read out that his former wife, Donna Fitchett, was guilty of the murder of his sons, Matthew 9 and Thomas 11. Fitchett, who pleaded not guilty to the murders of the children at the family home on September 6th, 2005, remained stoned-faced as the verdict was read out.
That's a really, really sad story. Oh,
it's awful. There's more detail here too. The 49-year-old registered nurse had stockpiled sedatives from her time working at a hospital and fed them to her children 2 days after Father's Day and 3 days after she told her husband she was leaving him. To get them to take the cocktail of sedatives, she told the boys they were going on a trip on a plane. I mean, the mind boggles. This would have to be the worst nightmare any father could endure. And he came home and found his boys dead body. I mean, I can't even read it. It's just too horrifying.
Oh, no. And I gather the marriage was failing. Both men and women kill their children during custody disputes, and they get into such a distressed emotional state that they basically think the kids are better off with them or not being there, or they can't bear to leave them behind. Oh, think twice.
Horrible. Don't do it.
Yeah, I wonder what the new Council to Prevent Violence Against Women and Children would say about a case like this, where it's actually a woman killing the children. When we group women and children together as a group of victims, we miss out on cases, really tragic cases like this. And if they're going to look at preventing violence, this is the sort of stuff they should be looking at.
Incredible.
Well, she claimed it was an act of love. I mean, she wrote a note to her psychiatrist. I'll quote a bit. It said, "Sadly, I am too broken to go on," she wrote in a suicide note posted to a psychologist hours before the murders. "Today, the boys will be given an overdose, as I cannot and wouldn't ever abandon them. They think we are going on an exciting trip today, but I've told them, and I've told them they need to take some medicine so they won't get airsick. I'm no coward, nor am I crazy. I see this as the greatest act of love." I mean,
well, the scary thing about that is that she may well appeal on the grounds of mental illness and get off scot-free. This happens a lot.
I interviewed a woman once who was in that situation, who tried to kill her kids in that sort of state of distress. And, you know, it's really hard to be judgmental about this. People, the system creates this enormous distress in these people.
Absolutely.
And this enormous stress. And if you think you're about to lose your children, people go to all sorts of lengths, and they're not thinking straight. It's really, there has to be another way. There really does.
Yeah, that's just an absolute tragedy. Nobody wins. No winners in this situation at all. Everybody loses. Lose, 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 lose. And these two poor young boys, 9 and 11, lost their lives.
Another and equally in some ways bizarre story.
Yeah, the title of this article is Childless De Factos in Family Court Win. Some of us may question whether it's actually a win. De facto couples without children will be given access to the family court to settle property disputes after they split up under sweeping changes announced by the Rudd government. Basically, the current laws deny de facto heterosexual couples without children access to the family court. They are only able to take their cases to state supreme courts if they want to settle property disputes. And so the new federal government is saying that to make family law consistent and uniform, that they're going to open up the family court to de facto heterosexual couples, and it says de facto same-sex couples. Now, this article seems to see that as a win. For most anyone who's had any experience of the family court, being given access to that defunct, corrupt institution, a totally dysfunctional institution, appears to me to be a big loss.
It is a very, very strange move by the Labor government. It's only a decade ago, or a little over a decade ago, that the most wide-ranging inquiry ever conducted into the federal justice system, which was done by the Howard government found overwhelming, quote-unquote, overwhelming disquiet with the family court and its processes, and that was both within the community and within the legal profession. Now, nothing really has changed in the decade since that really extensive finding. They interviewed over 3,000 people who had been through the court, and that was the reaction from everyone involved, that it was dysfunctional, the processes were unfair and unreasonable. The family reports are another whole thing which we've harped on quite some length of this show, but really nothing has been reformed in this institution. The former Chief Justice, Alastair Nicholson, is arguing that gay couples should also be included in the court. In a way, more the merrier, because the more people who see it for what it is, the better. But how are you going to determine who wins and who loses? The butch one loses.
Yes.
So if you're straight, the bloke loses. If you're gay, the butch one loses.
Well, like, that's at least that would be being consistent.
And if you're both lesbians, then they will there is a presumption of equal shared parenting, which is how it should be for everybody anyway. But you've got to be a lesbian to get that.
Now, talking of lesbians, we've got John Flanagan on the line, and the New South Wales government is moving to remove the word fathers from legislation, and there's a meeting in Parliament House next week. Are you there, John?
Hey, hi, John. Hi, Phil. Hi, Greg. How are you going?
Good, good, good.
Don't forget me, John. Ian, I'm here too.
John is with the Non-Custodial Parents Party and the Fairness in Child Support Group. And now, there's a tell us all about it. What's going on?
Yeah, for sure, John. What we have going to Parliament later this week is a new bill. It's called the Miscellaneous Acts Amendment Same-Sex Relationships Bill 2008. It's really going to have disastrous implications on fatherhood, because what they want to do is they want to take the word father out of the legislation and put in the word parent. On the face of it, doesn't sound too bad, but what they're doing is they're actually opening the way for fathers not to be important in on the birth certificates or another legislation. They just become another item on the agenda. So what we've done is we've organised a protest on Tuesday, the 3rd of June 2008. It will be held inside the New South Wales Parliament House in Macquarie Street, Sydney, in the Theatreette. Seating is available for 168 people. We'll have various speakers. They'll include Warwick Marsh and Alison Marsh from the Fatherhood Foundation, Wayne Butler from the Shared Parenting Council, Richard Egan from the Festival of Light, Barry Williams from the Lone Fathers Association, and many others from within the fatherhood and men's and pro-family movements.
What do you say to people who say this is just anti-gay?
No, definitely not. It's not anti-gay at all. I've got no problems with gay and lesbian relationships. I do have a problem, but with kids growing up in that sort of relationship, I think that there has to be a distinction between the two, and kids are better off in a heterosexual family.
Well, a lot of people would dispute that, and there's been various studies that throw the light either way. But nonetheless, why do they have to remove the word father? That's what gets me.
Well, the reason is, I think it's an underhand way of what they're doing is removing the word father, because that's a male term. They wish to have a neuter term, which is parent, and therefore what happens is that if you have two lesbians, for example, one lesbian can be the mother and the other lesbian can be the father, so as to speak, in accordance to the legislation.
It's going to lead to some very, very interesting custody disputes, that's for sure.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I was just listening to what you said earlier on, and particularly what Greg was saying. I don't really understand why the gay and lesbian community want to be governed by the Family Law Act. I personally think they're crazy. Their father having it the way it is now.
Absolutely crazy. Why would you want to put yourself through that extraordinarily complex, emotionally wrenching and difficult process? Look, just to wind up, just to repeat, if people want to go, how do they get there?
For sure. It's the New South Wales Parliament House, Macquarie Street, Sydney, between 10 o'clock and 1:30 p.m. on Tuesday, the 3rd of June. That's this coming Thursday. That's
and you just front up Tuesday. At the main entrance and ask just to go down to the theatre.
And ask for, we've got the actual, we've got a forum organised, and it's called Dads for Kids Forum.
Okay. Well, they're very friendly and helpful at the front desk. They'll point you straight to where it is.
Yeah, definitely. John, no problems at all.
Okay. We'll be back shortly. We'll be talking with Angela Conway from the Australian Family Association on that very issue. We'll be back.
Never satisfied.
now got Angela Conway. She's the national spokeswoman for the Australian Family Association. Welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Good morning, John.
Yeah, we've never had you on the show before. It's great.
Thank you.
Okay, now, we've been talking a bit about this move to take the word father off all the legislation in New South Wales. What do you think about this?
I guess we don't really understand why. We've got a whole body of social science research which is pointing to the fact that natural parents are really important to kids, and we know that natural fathers are really important to the well-being of children, and yet we see legislatures like the New South Wales Parliament seeking to step away from that and to more or less treat a partner who has no natural parenting relationship with a child as being able to supplant a natural father, and you know, to take the word father off the birth certificate is a pretty radical step in our view.
What gets me is they've never mentioned this in the lead up to the last election. It's never been put out there for discussion. There's been no consultation with stakeholders, as they like to call the various groups. No debate whatsoever. They've just decided to go ahead and do this. I don't see what the electoral gain is, for a start.
I guess it's designed to meet the need of a particularly a small lobby group concerned with gay parenting, and we've seen these moves in various European countries. You know, the pressure is on here. I think in Victoria we're expecting legislation that may have a similar effect shortly. But, yeah, I mean, I guess our concern is that it's reflective of particular small lobby groups' concerns, and it's running in the face of social science evidence which indicates that, you know, we have to stop regarding natural dads as irrelevant to children's well-being. And we know that you know, that there are, on top of that, evidence which talks about the importance of dads, which talks about the importance of parents to children. We also know that, you know, a whole range of young people have grown up as a result of assisted reproductive technology and gamete donors, and they are reporting a great sense of loss in terms of their own capacity to have self-identity.
Yeah, they all want to know where they came from and who their dad was. It's just hardwired, basically. They don't want to know what their genetics are, and they want to meet dad, don't they?
Well, it appears to be, from these people's accounts, it appears to be a very, very deep-seated need that they were surprised by. You know, no one sort of sat down from the Australian Family Association and told them this is what they should be feeling. These people have discovered this within themselves completely independently of any sort of political debate, and I think that we should be paying attention, and I think these young people are quite brave to step out and talk about this, and I think we should be listening to their experience.
Is that a study you just did recently?
No, it's not a study. It's a range of young people who have spoken in the media over the last quite few years and have organised groups like Tangled Webs, which are basically calling for, you know, moratoriums on the use of donor gametes, or, you know, greater care with registries and things like this, because these kids, these young people, are saying that this has really very, very seriously impacted their lives. And whilst they acknowledge the love and the care and so on of their parents, they feel this sort of real need, and it's been gnawing away at them. So, you know, I think these people are speaking directly from their own experience, and I think it's very sad that we're not listening to that and we're not connecting up the dots. So, you know, a child should be able to see on their birth certificate, yes, here is the man who was my father, here is the man, whether he is a gamete donor who can be traced, or, you know, a dad that I can locate in the community and have a relationship. Here is this person who I come from, who has my genetic, who shares with me a genetic heritage that's individual and unique. And young people need this, and the birth certificate should acknowledge these fundamental human realities. And I think there's plenty of scope to have additional information on the birth certificate about, you know, additional, you know, parent, step-parent or parent figures beyond and in addition to the mother and the father. But I think that children need to know and need to be able to identify their own natural mother and their own natural father, and they need to be able to have a relationship with those people. And preferably, I mean, we would certainly say the evidence clearly points to the fact that children are best served by having by growing up in a home in which their mum and dad are together. But, you know, obviously there are situations where that can't happen, and so we've always said that, you know, that the father, in the case of separation and so on, that the father and the mother really need to ensure that the kids are having a close involvement with their both their natural mum and their natural dad, because, you know, it's really important to them.
There's also a medical need as well, in terms of susceptibility to cancers and various diseases which are hereditary, which you have a genetic predisposition for. If you don't know who your genetic parents are, then you don't know if you have a likelihood of getting breast cancer or bowel cancer, or there's no family history available to you of what you are likely to be susceptible to in a medical sense.
Yeah, the medical stuff's really important, but I think it's sort of like, it's sort of the most prominent issue. I think that, you know, a lot of these young people are talking about a real sense of dislocation, and beyond even that level of medical issues, there's also the issue of these people being uncertain about the people in the community that they encounter, whether these people are related to them and siblings and so on. And, you know, there are accounts of, you know, some people discovering that, you know, there were multiple siblings in a community in which they were not aware of. Now, you know, these have quite significant medical and social ramifications for these young people as well. And again, we're rushing ahead to suit a particular small group in the community's desire to be given preeminent status in this sort of equation. And we're failing to take account of very strong evidence from a range of different sources that this course of action is probably not a good thing to do.
Now, you've said that the removal of the word fathers from the legislation in New South Wales is part of a national and international picture of eroding the traditional family and the concept of a natural parent. And you say that it is going on all around the world. It is a particular agenda. It is designed to reconstruct families as being anything but mum, dad and the kids, and whether a bloke is homosexual or not, his fatherhood is important, and being a father to that child is important. So can you just talk a bit about that? I mean, it really is going on all around the world, isn't it?
Look, I mean, there's been a huge debate in the United Kingdom about, you know, the latest ART amendments, legislative amendments, and, you know, there was a debate about whether we should make that the idea of a father figure should be maintained in the legislation, and that has been,
and that's been removed now, hasn't it?
Decisively defeated, and we now have no regard for the presence of a father in the picture. Now, admittedly, previously the language was very vague, and it talked about father figures. And I guess what I'd be keen to maintain all along is that a father figure is just a second-rate substitute. They can be great guys, they can step in and do a wonderful job, but they can never fully substitute for the natural dad. And, you know, my hat's off to any stepdad out there who's doing a wonderful job with their kids. But I think even those stepdads know that ultimately, you know, it would be ideal if those kids could have their natural dad in the picture, if, they, you know, their natural dad had stepped up to the plate. But the reality is that natural dads are really important. Already in the UK that was slipping, and now even the idea of a father figure has been dispensed with. In various European countries, you know, these sorts of things have already happened. And, you know, we're seeing in Victoria there's been recommendations to acknowledge, you know, partners and so on as parents, you know, somehow supplanting or eclipsing the role of a father and so on in the picture. And, yeah, I think it's an effort to try and, say, inviting state intervention to essentially reconstruct a family according to, you know, particular models and so on, rather than actually going back to nature and seeing the family as essentially an organic an organic
unit.
Yeah, yeah, or construct.
An organic being rather than a legal construct. And that's, I think, where the big difference lies, that some people are saying we can turn anybody we like into a parent, and that parent will be completely adequate because they will be constructed as a parent. And love's enough if you love your girlfriend or your boyfriend, you know, that, and if you, you say you love each other enough to commit to children, that will be enough. But I think that the research is saying actually love's never enough, sadly, that we also need, you know, the sort of organic bonds that connect people, that they, this is what sort of is the sort of the framework and the substrata or the foundations which makes that love bear the fruit.
This seems to be fundamental wisdom that used to be in our society, because traditionally a wife would take on the husband's name and the children would all have the father's surname. And this has been the traditional role right up and through history. And it seems like we've lost track of that fundamental wisdom that, that a father is actually vital, that he, as the head of a traditional family unit, which is a traditional, I guess, chauvinistic way of looking at it. But we really just seem to be going completely in the opposite direction from what stood us in good stead for thousands and thousands of years of our evolution.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we don't have to say that the alternative is a chauvinistic unit, but traditionally, I think a lot of human societies, not just Christian ones, conceived of marriage as in some way like, you know, two becoming one flesh. And, you know, I think that that was the model of marriage and family formation that sort of governed society and generated society and underpinned society for, you know, many, you know, 1,000 years or more, perhaps longer, and yeah, maybe thousands of years. But, you know, this is this organic concept that two people were joining together and, you know, you will be the father of my children, you will be the mother of my children, whether I go and live in another house or not, but that will never change. And these children are related to each other, you know, each is the child of my mother. You know, these are the bonds that don't go away. And, you know, I think human societies really did have an understanding of that. But it's just this recent move to try and negate that concept by saying we will construct a family in all sorts of ways. And what we're seeing, particularly in some places like Canada and so on, is we're seeing children being allocated with, you know, a three-parent model and so on. And there's moves in the United States and Canada to move away from the two-parent model and to actually construct families in which you've got, you know, a number of so-called parents in some sort of unified arrangement relating to children as if, you know, as parents. And yeah, I think children will be the big losers out of this sort of free-for-all that's sort of we're heading into.
Now, Angela, it's interesting. One of the things that, that intrigues me is they seem to be going down this sort of you know, politically correct, gender-neutral term. So we're talking about parents and partners and all of this sort of thing, removing all of the you know, these words father from the language. But they don't seem to be removing the word mother from the language. If they were serious about making everything, you know, politically correct and just talking about parents and anyone can raise kids, why are they emphatically keeping the language of mother but only removing the language of father? Why not talk about just parents generically? I see that there's actually an anti-male slant in this because, you know, it's inconsistent. What, do you have any thoughts on this?
Look, I mean, in some jurisdictions overseas, they have tried to dispense with the word mother. I mean, I think in Spain, I think it's progenitor one and progenitor two. Not that some of those people ever had anything to do biologically with progeneration or anything like that, but yeah, I guess it varies across jurisdictions, but certainly there is a push from some radical sectors to push fathers out of the picture. Now, there's a, you know, there's a sort of a fairly radical family law jurisprudence going on in the United States, for example. And one of their leading lights, Martha Feinman, she talks about totally reconstructing and reconceptualising family and marriage in the United States. And she's saying that we should step away from considering the relationship between men and women or women and their female partner or whatever. And we should see family, we could reconceptualise family as a caring dyad. And she says, of course, in most of those situations, it will be the mother and the child, and that will be the family that the state will pay attention to and support. and all other people in, you know, related to that caring dyad will be considered as just social relationships that the state has no business in. Now, I mean, there would be some cases within that conceptualisation of fathers being the caring dyad, but I think that the practical results will be, if her vision was fulfilled, that fathers would just become these free-floating, socially connected people of no great significance to the state or to the community or society.
Except that they provide child support.
Yeah, so exactly. So, you know, I think that there are significant concerns about how some of these radical groups and academics conceptualise fathers and their role in regard to families and children. And, yeah, I think there are a lot of big questions around their status, their capacity to be recognised as important in the life of their children. And then, of course, on top of that, there are the other issues in terms of, how does the state then support these caring dyads? And we know that, you know, in the United States particularly, but, you know, they've led the way, but, you know, in Australia too, the state gets quite heavily involved in ensuring that fathers are paying and helping to foot the bill to support that caring dyad. So, I think our communities need to decide whether we think that, you know, natural connections, organic connections are valuable. I know we think it's important when we shop for our fruit and veg and our meat, but, do we think it's important in terms of our human relationships and our family life? And I think if people decide that that is important, then they need to start letting governments know that, that they think that fathers and mothers are very important to the children, and that the governments need to stop trying to erode the status, particularly of fathers.
We've been talking with Angela Conway. She's the National Spokeswoman for the Australian Family Association. Look, thank you so much for coming onto the show. Hope to have you on again.
Thanks, John.
It's a really very, very radical move, removing the word fathers from legislation right across New South Wales, and really alarmed a lot of people. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking with Tony McLean from the Think Twice program. We'll be back.
I love you. Show.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. There's been a letter published in today's Sydney Morning Herald titled "Education Systems Are Failing Our Boys and Young Men." It's the first word, the main letter there. Ian,
fill us in on that. Written by our very own Greg Andreessen, who just introduced the subject matter. Good work, mate. You write, this is Education Week, a time to reflect on the successes and failures of the education system. One of its failures that rarely appears in the media is the way schools and universities are failing our boys and young men. In 1994, the New South Wales Government Advisory Committee on Education, Training and Tourism commissioned an inquiry into boys' education under Stephen O'Doherty. His report identified a range of reasons for concern and suggested ways to improve educational outcomes for boys. However, it was subjected to sustained attack from influential policymakers. Sue Walpole, then Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner, argued that attention to boys should be less focused on measurable disadvantages and more concerned about correcting the poor behaviour of males. The gender gap between boys and girls for participation in Year 12 and higher education has continued to widen. Between 1993 and 1999, the proportion of female enrolments at university increased from 53.3% to 55.2%, while male enrolments decreased from 46.7% to 44.8%. Almost 50% more females than males graduated from Australia's universities in 2006. Given that the academic outcomes for girls were turned around in less than 10 years, it is worrying that 15 years after the first report on boys' education, the situation for boys is deteriorating. This suggests that efforts to improve educational outcome for boys to date have been either misguided or poorly implemented. It is high time we start to fix the education systems that are failing our boys and young men so badly. And that's Greg's letter in this morning's Sydney Morning Herald, which we advise everybody to grab a copy of and read. But that's making some very good points there. I mean, the education system has become definitely very female-centric. The number of female teachers, and of course boys and girls learn differently, as we know. Boys learn from doing stuff. Girls learn from talking about it. It just is obvious from the results of university graduation that boys are being left behind by a system that is not catering for their needs.
And unfortunately, it seems that as this letter says, the previous attempts to sort of fix it often don't look at fixing the system. And the idea is we've got to fix these boys. You know, there's something wrong with these
little
boys.
You're correcting their behaviour.
And they're these little proto-patriarchs that are, if only we can raise them to cook and clean more and
be more like girls. Be like girls. But really, that's what they're saying is...
They don't say that out loud, but that's the subtext, absolutely.
That's what they mean,
Then somehow this will help them. But first of all... it doesn't help them. It hasn't meant, these things hasn't meant that more boys are going to university. In fact, they're leaving university and high school in droves. And the other thing is, we didn't do that with girls. We didn't, when girls were seen to be struggling in the education system in the 60s and 70s, we didn't say, oh, the problem's with these silly little girls. They're all dumb and they can't really do maths and engineering because they're, poor, stupid little girls.
And they're never going to be truck drivers because they can't reach the pedals.
We said, there must be something wrong with the system. Let's fix the system. But we don't do that with boys. So very strange. And look, I really think that a lot of this is to do with the fact that the education unions, which are some of the most powerful unions in the country, are dominated by feminists and women who disagree that there is any crisis in boys' education. They disagree that we should be getting more male teachers into schools or that there's any issue with boys underperforming. And they basically control academia and education in this country. And you can't really get in there to change anything if the entire union believes there's no problem.
It comes from a fundamental belief that boys and girls are the same, and it's the way we bring them up that causes their behaviour. So the thinking is that if we dress our boys in pink and give them dolls, they'll grow up to be more placid and more girl-like than if we give them guns and and treat them like boys, basically, and dress them in blue. But this is fundamentally incorrect, because I know for my son, if I didn't give my son a gun to play with, he'd pick up a stick and he'd use that to play gun games.
Or he'd rip off the Barbie doll's leg and turn it into a sword.
Exactly, which is something that girls just don't do. I mean, the sex differences are fundamental. It's not something that is conditioned, it's not something that is taught to our children. It is just the way they are. It's fundamental.
And look, even if it was society that was responsible for genderizing our children, and even if we could raise boys to be more like girls, would that be a good thing? We'd have no one mining our raw materials. We'd have no one transporting any goods around the country. We'd have nothing in the supermarkets. We'd have no one picking up our trash. How would society possibly function if we had both boys and girls being raised as girls? Girls don't choose those sort of professions, and so no one would basically do that. And God help us if we were actually attacked and needed a military to defend the country.
Well, it's a great coup getting a letter in the Sydney Morning Herald, and the Bible of the chattering classes here in Sydney. And it's a great coup, and it just shows that if you do put material out, if you do write letters, things get published.
I wanted to mention that Michael Woods from the University of Western Sydney co-authored that letter, in fact wrote most of it. So all credit to you, Michael, as well.
And don't forget, you can listen to this program at www.dadsontheair.net and all our last past shows. We'll be back.
I was only outside when you say you need a
And we're talking with Toni McLean. She is the principal counsellor for the Think Twice program. Are you there, Toni?
Yes, good morning, John.
Look, thank you very much for coming onto the show. Toni McLean, as we said, is the principal counsellor for the Think Twice suite of services. Together with a supportive and experienced group of facilitators, she offers a range of options for individuals and couples experiencing difficulty in their relationships, all from normal conflict through to all forms of abuse, as well as physical violence. And you have a unique or sort of think outside the square sort of approach to the whole issue of domestic violence.
Yes, I do, and it came about from my experience of working within the square, starting that some years ago.
Was this when you were working for the Department of Corrections? Was this right?
It started even before that, working for a large religious organisation that has a counselling arm, and their approach at that time was very strongly feminist-based, and that was what I first learnt. And that's what I first started to preach.
And what can you just give our listeners, what are the basics of that feminist approach?
Okay, the basic of the feminist approach is that the responsibility for all domestic violence resides fairly and squarely, or should I say squarely, on the man's shoulders. In brackets, they acknowledge that sometimes women are violent, but there are reasons for that. And the assumption is made that if a man is violent, it's because he is operating his family as a patriarchy and he wants to be the one in charge and he'll use whatever means he can to maintain that.
So you obviously saw that this perspective wasn't working or there were problems with that?
Well, what I actually found was that the more men I worked with and also at the same time in separate groups, the more women victims I worked with, I realised neither story was really true, that women weren't completely victims necessarily. And also, men weren't necessarily trying to maintain power and control in their relationships in that way. And I, in fact, found that with regard to the men, a majority of men didn't fit the prevailing story, really.
Now, you did obviously find some... Did you find some men who do fit that story, but a lot of men that don't? Is that the case?
That's exactly right. I guess these aren't really reliable figures, but my sense over the years that I've been doing this work is that there would be no more than a third of men who wind up at these groups in whatever way, and usually if they're like that, they've come through the legal system. Maybe about a third of the men are really very clinging very tightly to their idea of being in control in relationship. I find at least two-thirds of men who, even though they may see themselves as the primary sort of provider and the person who's responsible for the well-being of the family, they don't see themselves as needing to operate as sort of patriarchs and maintain control in whatever way.
So you obviously moved on from that approach to the courses that you're running now. So
yes.
What is? Can you give us an outline of your current approach that you obviously feel works a lot better and maybe is more flexible and tailored to the needs of your clients?
Well, I did move on. Originally it was very difficult because all of the reading in the area just leads you down one path. Oh, pardon me, that's my dog.
It's all right.
So it took me a while to discover that there were other ways of viewing violence in relationships. Once I did, it was like entering a... Oh, goodness.
That dog is going ballistic. Do you want to put it outside or something? We'll just talk for a moment while you put the dog out the back door. Is that all right?
There we go.
It's just a bit hard.
How's that? So once I discovered that there was another whole world of literature out there that I could learn from, I gobbled that up as best I could. And my approach now is firstly to focus on the man as an individual with his own story about how he got to where he is and as somebody within the context of a family. So, what is the whole picture that's going on here?
What do you think of the sort of broader thing? I mean, the Australian government seems to have gone into a hyperdrive over the whole issue of domestic violence at the moment with the announcement of a national council for the... what's the exact wording?
Prevention of violence against
women and children.
Women and children, but no thought of preventing violence against men. What do you think about this new council?
I'm alternating between being very hopeful, but also, I'm also not holding my breath, I guess. It's going to be a long, I'm excited that we are even asking the question now, which the question which is now being asked, is what do we need to do for men? It's still being asked.
Who's asking that?
As abusers, but at least it's being asked.
So all men, and you've got Tanya Plibersek, who's the minister responsible, running around claiming one in three women are the victims of domestic violence, which is a figure which has been pretty well thoroughly discredited by many different academics all around the world. I mean, and it's being run by the founder of the Australian White Ribbon Day campaign. So why is there hope in any of this?
I guess, and I bear all that in mind, and I do, and I also, I mean, I understand and I know who advises Tanya Plibersek as well, so I know where she gets her figures from.
And they really are farcical, aren't they? What are you saying, that a third of Australian men bash their women? That's basically what you're trying to say.
Well, I think the big debate, and I don't get into a debate around figures because I think people produce the figures they want to make the case they can, and I think it deflects us from the real issue, which is how do we support and foster safe and happy families? That, for me, is the issue. And the figures first came out of studies which focused only on those situations where there was severe violence, and then they were extrapolated to the population at large. Well, we know that's not the case. If we survey the population at large, we get very different figures.
And if we survey the population at large, we're looking at every incident of violence, so perhaps one little slap by one partner to another partner in a one-off incident when, you know, they were both very stressed or maybe drunk or whatever, that gets counted as the same importance in a large survey as someone systematically controlling and abusing their partner.
That's right. Mm. I mean, my approach is that we are all entitled to live free of any form of violence from anyone. That, to me, is the ultimate ideal, and I don't care who's doing the violence. I think in the interests of happy relationships, it would be lovely if we could get to the point that people could all handle their stresses and their conflicts without resorting to even that kind of high-conflict behaviour, if you like. But when it does happen, it needs to be seen within the context of the couple and the family.
We've also got to take into account the fact that we've got the media, television, you know, all the programming, is a lot of it is very violent. A lot of it is people not coping in family situations. I mean, that's where the drama comes from, is that they basically push their characters, you know, beyond breaking point, and there is a lot of violence, there's a lot of war, you know, it's in your lounge room. I mean, you know, this cultural, on the one hand, violence is seen as a form of entertainment, you know, but in reality, obviously, it isn't that. It's something disgusting. It's something that we, as a species, need to grow out of very quickly.
I agree entirely. We're very happy to go to the football on the weekend and see a good sort of, you know, punch-up happening and call that entertainment. And quite rightly, if that happens in the home on the Saturday evening, we're horrified by it.
It's not very often we go and watch females have a biff up for entertainment. Whenever there's entertainment, it's vastly more likely that it's men that are going to be involved in the violence.
Don't you watch mud wrestling, Greg?
I suspect that it's not the violence that people are being entertained by in that case. So what do you actually do, couples counselling as well? I know that obviously if you're looking at the actual dynamic of the relationship and how it works and the triggers for perhaps violent episodes or incidents, do you actually work with couples together and to work through their relationship?
After carefully assessing a couple, I will work with them as a couple and individually. I mean, a very typical situation that would happen would be there is a situation where a man has been physically violent in some way, which may just be, or say just, it may be pushing and shoving, it may be more than that, but it's not an entrenched form of operating in the relationship. It's violence that's come about through, you know, the situation that they're in or through lacking the skills to deal with, you know, conflict and stress in other ways. That's a fairly typical presentation. What I would do in that case is to initially work with the man around just his own, you know, self-control. When we're satisfied that he's not a risk to himself or his partner or indeed his children, then I can work with the couple separately and together. What we will invariably find, because nobody's perfect in relationships, is that there will be some things with, and I'm saying typically here because I'll say women, the woman in this case, as the victim, if you like, of the physical behaviour, there will be some things that she can do differently in relationship that is not making her responsible for anything her partner's done. And also, if the genders are reversed, you know, my language would be reversed, but I'm talking about we're much more likely to get this kind of situation in counselling than the other way around, for whatever reason. And then I would work with the couple around together how they manage their conflict, their decision-making, problem-solving. Also resolving things around attachment issues that they may have in their relationship, because to me that's fundamental, how secure we are in our attachment to one another is at the bottom line of having a happy relationship.
So you can move a sick relationship to a healthy relationship. I thought that was really interesting, the display on your website, from unhealthy to healthy relationship. So you can move a really dysfunctional and unhappy affair or marriage into a happy and successful one?
That can be done if the couple have the willingness and the honesty to do that, and it is an absolute delight to work with a couple who do have that, where they are honest enough to own up whatever it is that they're not doing well in the relationship, and to have the confidence that the other person isn't going to attack them with that.
But I imagine equally important, they would have to be facilitated by a counsellor or team of counsellors who are also extremely sensitive and flexible and really treat them as individuals with individual needs rather than imposing some sort of set agenda upon their relationship or their personalities.
Absolutely, absolutely. You've got to begin where your couple are at. I don't always personally agree with a relationship structure that clients may have, but it's not my relationship. So long as that structure and how it works is safe for both partners and they are happy with it and they're succeeding in their daily lives with it, that's what's most important.
And, of course, that the children are also
absolutely
safe and happy, yeah.
Yep. And we do have to be very careful. We're always saying, well, the children are paramount, and that's absolutely true. But sometimes I can almost, and it may be hard to give specific examples, but here when that almost becomes an excuse for bad behaviour from one parent towards another. They can actually use that to set up a situation in some ways. But yes, certainly the genuine welfare of the children is most important.
Well, there is nothing more abusive than the removal of a child from a parent, and that's one weapon that women use repeatedly. They use the legal system to basically bash up and destroy their men.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I think it's very important, and I tried to push at a workshop I attended yesterday for the Office for Women, which is it's very important that, particularly if a situation comes to the point of the attention of the police, that there be a very, very thorough assessment of the whole family situation, so that right from that point we can have a very clear picture of who's doing what to whom. And that can help prevent a little further down the track things like AVOs or even just contact with the police or whatever being used against, well, clearly it's usually the fathers, but should it be the other way, then also it applies equally.
So you remove the potential for false allegations, I guess, or the likelihood that false allegations might be accepted by a court or by the authorities.
I think so. I hope that we can do that. Where situations don't come to that point that early on, then there needs to be a parallel process with the family court, however that works, that there's a very thorough investigation should allegations only emerge.
The family court has no investigative capability whatsoever, wouldn't trust it to do any investigate
right.
anything.
That they rely on docs or whatever else to do that for them, and then they don't necessarily act on it. And it's still not a very thorough investigation. It tends to be very one-sided.
Of course. Look, both you and Greg did attend workshops yesterday in the lead-up to this National Council to Reduce Violence Against Women and Children. What was your impression of that?
Well, look, I think that the whole framework of the way in which it was set up is pretty clearly indicative that if there has been a shift, it's a very small one. That just the way that it was structured, the fact that they lumped domestic violence and sexual violence in together, which to me, are completely separate beasts. Whoever's doing what to whom, we shouldn't be lumping those two areas together. Secondly, it was still coming from the assumption that most violence is perpetrated by men.
And that the only victims worth worrying about are women and children. I heard the phrase come up repeatedly that the safety of women and children is paramount. Not yes. the safety of victims of violence, but only the safety of women and children. And that mantra yes. still seems to be there.
I'm very disappointed that our language is still gendered like that. I would much rather talk about keeping families safe, which isn't the language that I use. And it is easy still to slip into talking about offenders as men and victims as women, because that ends up being who we deal with for a whole range of reasons. But I think the more we keep using that kind of language, the more that we will forget and ignore the fact that men are victims of domestic violence.
And sexual violence. I mean, one third of sexual assaults, especially with children, can be boys. Now, looking at the positives of yesterday's event, did you feel, in some sense, excited that there at least were other views being raised? I mean, yourself and Steve Sutton, and
yes.
that it wasn't just a one-sided sort of, you know, the old Duluth model being trotted out as you know, which could, that was my fear.
Look, I was really excited about that. I looked through the names of those whom I knew were going to be there, and there were people I didn't know, so they were unknowns for me. But I was very pleased to see that there were a lot of names that might have been there that weren't, given especially the current climate in New South Wales in particular.
Yes. Oh, this harm, this hysteria over domestic violence is doing so much harm, I think. Look, can you just give people the details of your website and how to contact you? And we'll have to move on, I'm afraid. We're out of time already.
Yep. Okay, my website is obviously www.thinktwiceprogram.net.
I'll repeat that, www.thinktwiceprogram.net.
That's right.
And we'll have the details of that up on our website as well.
Yeah.
And I guess we should mention you're in the Mittagong Barrel area, is that correct?
I am, that's right. Yeah. My practice and my group work is in Barrel and Mittagong, yeah.
And there's a huge amount of interesting information up on that website, and interestingly, you do say on that site that best practice now recognises that a significant number of victims are men. So it's really interesting. Look, Tony, thank you so much for coming onto the show, and hopefully we'll have you again shortly. I think this whole domestic violence issue will be running hot over the next few months.
I'd be delighted. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
We'll be back.
Bye bye.
The greatest feeling I ever felt.
we've got Richard Farr from K-Rights Radio in the US on the line. You there, mate?
I'm here. How are you guys doing today?
We're really well.
We're rocking.
It's always good to talk to you guys, I tell you. You guys are doing a lot of great work and staying consistent, persistent with it. And you know, I think around the world, things are starting to shake up a little bit. We would hope so.
You would hope so, but I remain unconvinced. What is going on in the U.S.?
Well, you know, this weekend is Memorial Day weekend, and this is a weekend that we here in America honor those that have fallen in past wars. And something I was reflecting on earlier today is the fact that you just think of all the fathers, the dads that laid their lives down so these wild feminist groups could go out and, you know, create the problems for dads that they've created. It's just an absolute shame to think that our kids could possibly be walking into just a whole new social level of reengineering. And here in America, we're getting with a number of federal officials that are starting to look into issues such as child support fraud and child support corruption, which will move over into equal custody and those issues there, and maybe really start to crack this egg a little bit.
Well, you've had a supposedly conservative president there for nearly 8 years, George Bush, who clearly hasn't done anything about this. And we've just had 11 years of a conservative government. They've just lost power. And he didn't fix family court, child support agency, domestic violence, hysteria, you name it. They didn't fix it. So what hope have we got?
Something, you know, I've been talking to a number of senators and their aides on a federal level here in America, and one of them looked at me straight in the eyes, and I think that this says a lot about what the problem and where the solutions lie, is that he looked right at me and says, Richard, do you realize that if you solve this, how much money the states are going to lose? And that's what this all comes down to. This is not about in the best interest of our children. None of it is. Family court, none of it is. It's about the best interest of the state, and that's what we've got to expose and bring out to the public all around the world.
And I guess the best interests of all the associated professionals as well, whether they're lawyers or psychiatrists or basically the whole family law industry that makes a lot of money out of creating conflict and problem in families.
Oh, yeah, and they've become masters at it. You know, first thing out, protection orders, the atomic bomb of divorce, begin to immediately separate the father from the children on false allegations. It all has to come to exposure, and there's been a lot of efforts. But I think, you know, there's more guys like what you're doing there in Australia, what we're doing here in the States, really starting to get the word out more and through the internet and all the things that are going on. I know that it's been kind of a log jam to the point, but starting to get a feeling that it's wiggling loose just a little bit. And I think some of the areas that we're really going to win on is dealing with the money issues and cracking that open and showing real life corruption there, because you can follow a dollar and you can, or a, you know, you can follow the tendered bill and figure out if it went to the place that it was supposed to go to or not, and if people got credit for the way that they were supposed to on the payment or not. So there's a lot of things that I think that are coming our way, but they're not here yet. But, you know, I encourage everyone to stay into the movement, to stay strong in their thoughts and to stay, you know, healthy in what they're doing, because I think that we're going to see a lot happen in 2009 and 2010.
Now, for those listeners who don't know anything about it, how's K-Rights Radio going these days?
Well, you know, we've made an arrangement with YouTube. We have found some friends inside of YouTube, and we've started our own TV channel. And we're doing now, we're producing Family Law Live, which is direct and live from Las Vegas every Friday night. And we talk about nothing but family law issues, and anything that deals with the family. You know, here in America, we have a tremendous problem with illegal immigration. And we talk, we even go into that area and show connections of how things like illegal women come into America, have babies here so it can establish their citizenship, and then turn around and take the father for everything they can using the system, which, you know, they should never have had access to in the first place.
No, but so that's common. How common is that?
It's very common, actually. It's become kind of the, the power play call among the illegal aliens in this country. It's caught on. You can find the problem they're talking about it on local news channels, news reports here. So it has mushroomed in its problem, and the state just follows right along with it because of the federal dollars they receive back for all the chicanery they do against fathers.
So why do you think a conservative president such as George Bush has not tackled this massive industry?
I think that the problem is no longer conservative or liberal. I think the problem has come down to there's too much money to be made. And these boys have all made very insidious friendships. Like, for instance, the state of Texas, where Mr. George Bush originates from. He was governor. There's a man there named Greg Abbott, who is the attorney general and had been attorney general for the whole period of time. He has gotten in bed with another man named Casey Hoffman, who owns the largest privatized child support enforcement system in America. And Greg Abbott, a elected state official, hired this privatized child support enforcement agency CEO to be his child support enforcement czar. And in turn, they just began to corruptly rake in millions, almost billions of dollars. So what you've got here is you've got these boys are all playing a mean, nasty, dirty little game, and they're taking the money on the back of our children. And they're going out there and trying to paint this whitewash to the public about the fact of deadbeat dads and dads that don't care, which we all know is absolutely, totally untrue and ludicrous from its very origination. So we're, you know, these things have not been discovered until here very recently. And so these are things that we're able to bring up to our federal legislators and say, you know, we really would like you to look at this.
Is the suicide rate very high amongst separated dads over there?
It's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. I heard of a fellow not too long ago, just a month ago, where he hung himself. He came home from family court. This was in Wichita, Kansas. They had taken his children for no reason at all. He had been, you know, he had been a doting dad. And he was so destroyed and distraught that he hung himself. So suicide is just a tragic, it's a tragic statistic here in America, and it's just absolutely unnecessary. Just like I know the rate there in Australia has just jumped through the roof. And we've got to quit sending dads to their graves to the magistrates in the black robes that sit behind family courts. These people need to come under closer scrutiny, and they need to come under a deeper watch. And it's taking guys like you and, the biggest issue for us as fathers, as non-custodial parents around the world is now is the time that, you know, we can keep our own autonomies, but we must find a way to unite and begin to lift our voices up louder than they've been lifted before. And there's been groups that have elevated it to different bars, but we've got to keep the pressure on, and we cannot stop.
Yeah, that seems to be the problem, is uniting the men's groups. That's one of the problems that we have over here. There are a number of men's groups, and we're all basically pushing the same barrow. We've got the same message, but finding a united cause, this is the difficult thing. Well, everybody seems to want to do their own thing, as opposed to women, who seem to network a lot easier, and the girls can all get together and kind of agree on a forward thrust a lot better than us blokes seem to be able to.
You know, and that's very true, and here's something that we as men, as fathers, as leaders, as organizers in this movement need to begin to realize. We as men have a tribal instinct, and we have the necessary need to protect our tribe for the survival of those around us. Where women have traditionally been those that have been in the cave and waited behind as the men went out to kill the bear, we as men must find a way, and it's been done many, many times in the past where many tribes have united to come against one giant bear. we have to realize that it doesn't matter that if it's equal custody, child support, CPS, DH, I mean, whatever you want to call this Leviathan, which is the system, we as fathers need to come together and know that we can stand in our own autonomy, but stand side by side with each other in the show of a force necessary to be the voice and be the fathers that we are and change this whole mess once and for all.
There seems to be that a lot of men who haven't gone through family breakup, who are still safely ensconced in their family with their children and their faithful wife, these men don't get it. They, you know, my friends that I've explained what I went through, I mean, most of them, the reaction was, you know, mate, get over it. I mean, that's just what happened to you. It's not a general phenomenon. You know, just get over it. That seems to be, you know, there seems to be so many men out there who really just don't realize what's actually going on when things go wrong. They don't realize that they can lose their house, they can lose their family, they can lose absolutely everything, they can be vilified, you know, they can be lied about in court and that stand up against them. They're, you know, valiantly telling the truth and trying to defend their family. They don't realize that when it comes to the crunch, they've got no rights. They can't accept that. It just seems fundamentally absurd to them.
You're absolutely right, and that's the ruse. That is the ruse that the system has tried to play on men for years. That's the ruse that mothers have played on sons. That's the ruse that sisters have played on brothers. You know, basically, I'm the woman, shut up and be quiet. And men have fallen into they've fallen into this crevice of submission. And, you know, it's like I say sometimes, you know, sometimes men have got their whole personality snapped shut and tight in their mama's purse. And men, you're right. It's time for men to stand up and to be men. Men have changed the world. Men have built bridges and buildings and monuments that, you know, has taken the man's strength. And men have got to realize that around the world, they still have not just the moral right, but the spiritual right to lead this whole world, this generation, and all cultures out of this mess that we have found ourselves in today.
Look, K-Rights Radio began fairly simply, and you were running 24/7, I think. How's the technology changing what you're doing with YouTube and all the rest of it now?
You know, we've moved very heavily into television and video work. You know, that's where I came from, that whole industry. So our technology's grown from just a simple little internet radio stream now to where, you know, we're producing a couple of major pieces. We're putting stuff up on YouTube on a regular basis, and we started our own little TV channel. So for us, it's been a progression into more technologies and more into, you know, adding the visual along with just the simple audio. But, you know, I go back sometimes and I'm just amazed at some of the information that was recorded during our early years. You know, even like our marathon with you guys and the connections with people, it's just been amazing. And I just have to keep optimistic.
And do dads relate more easily to the video, do you think?
I think they do. I think it, you know, it's the short, you know, feed it in a short bite philosophy, spoon feed it, not a lot of information at once, but a series of information over a period of time, which that does a lot of things also, is it keeps the repetition up there, and it just keeps people coming back to reassuring themselves that, you know, there's steps to be made. And, you know, one thing that we've been really messing around with is the idea of producing a video teaching people just how to basically protest, how to go and make a sign, and how to stand on a street corner and hold a sign up and just protest. And it doesn't matter if you're one, if you're a group. Could you imagine if we could start and get going around all the world where, you know, guys, just when they felt like it, which is kind of what it is right now, just go stand along a street corner with a sign in your hand saying, you know, reform. Put up whatever your issue is when it comes to this and just hold up the sign. Sooner or later, some news person in some community, some township somewhere is going to catch on, and it could light a fire.
We've been talking with Richard Farr. He's from K-Rights Radio. You can look at more of that on krightsradio.com. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air again. And we'll be back next week. Don't forget, we'll be covering the conference down at Parliament House on the removal of the word father from legislation right across New South Wales. We'll be back.
We're Dad's on the Air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask for